everybody, and welcome to Drive to Win. I'm Justin Bell. The show, of course, presented by the Win Las Vegas and brought to you by Mobile One for the love of driving. Well, what a weekend of motorsports. If you sat on your sofa all day indulging in caffeine and other beverages, I don't blame you. There was no reason to move anywhere else. We had the Monaco Grand Prix, we had the Indy 500, and we had the NASCAR race as well. It was a complete ecosystem of all sorts of fun. Some of the racing couldn't have been more different, actually, around the world, but we'll get to that in a minute. We're here to talk about the Monaco Grand Prix, but my guest has actually spanned Indy 500 and Monaco, and that is Stephanie Hansen. He joined us last season, but he is back. Can't wait to talk to him all about it. I did say Gunter Steiner was joining us. He has some travel plans mixed up, but he will be joining us in a few weeks' time. So I'm totally looking forward to that. Well, Monaco, I've been there a couple of times, never to race. I've been there to watch. Never got around to doing any of even the support races. Always wanted to, just to capture that feeling. But I sit there and look at that race with this mix of nostalgia, affection. It's just so ritualistic, historic in the history books of Formula One. But at the same time, it makes for absolutely bloody awful racing. It was all about qualifying. I even said to my daughter, Tallulah, I said, hey, babe, just watch on the app. Just watch qualifying. That will be basically the race. And we weren't far wrong, were we? Why is that? It's the cars since the 50s and 60s are four times the size, five times the size. They are so wide. They have so much downforce. They're always worrying about blinking tire management. And, you know, they can't overtake. So that processional air of the Monaco Grand Prix really is, as I say, it's about pomp and ceremony. But in so many ways, so is the race. Just to illustrate that fact, I think it's the first time in Formula One history, the top 10 at the end of the race were the same as they started the race. That doesn't mean for a lot of excitement, does it? But it is special. The celebrities, the yachts, you've got Tommy Hilfiger, you've got all these, I mean, really, really famous people. Some of the other races get like the B and C listers. This one gets the A-grade quality influencers and celebrities, and I guess it makes for an amazing show. But talk about inaccessible. That is a race to go to only if you have the coin. But of course, Charles Leclerc won at home for the first time. It was only his sixth ever Formula One race, which I totally was blown away by. That little fact had escaped me. But, you know, he's had pole twice before, and he must be wondering what it would take. And they even said he had a curse, but rather like Lando having a curse to win. That is just total rubbish. But he overcame it, and, I mean, I think he just did. He had a weekend, a sublime weekend, a weekend where he was not going to be beaten. He was the first Monegasque to win the race in 93 years. So let's just say there were probably some historical pressure on him. And I'm sure from the royal family downwards, everybody patting him on the back. It must have been quite an amazing weekend for him in so many ways. He said his pace came from taking more risks than anyone else, which you definitely have to do there on that track. You have to be, you know, you see how close they get to the walls. I mean, to do that every lap, every corner, I can tell you from personal experiences, if you get it wrong, and I was never in their league, it all goes upside down very quickly, as we saw. But just the way he drove was sublime. I think it was almost Senna-like in the way. I mean, I know that's a risky thing to say, but his lap, qualifying lap, the way he controlled the race was just absolutely fabulous. Of course, he also dedicated the race to Jules Bianchi, who passed away a few years ago, another Formula One driver, but also to his father, who was the motivator behind his career. So just in every way, a feel-good, and you could see it up and down the pit lane. Carlos Sainz was beside himself, happy for him as well. So just a really great one. He's only 31 points down in the championship to Max now. This time last year, the gap was almost unreachable already. So I think we're in for some very exciting times. Ferrari, definitely on a roll then. Their upgrades are all working, and it's coming together very nicely. I'm going to talk more about that with Stefan when we get into it. I'm definitely going to keep the first part of the show a little shorter because we have Indy and Formula One to talk about with Stefan. McLaren. Well, we came off the back of obviously a couple of great weekends for McLaren, but Oscar Piastri was actually the pacemaker in every single way. And I don't know about you, but I love to see his spirit, his raciness, and, you know, right up there, second weekend in a row. And yes, there was this issue, and again, I really want to dig into it with Stefan about the tire choices. But the way Oscar was right up Charles's chuff all the way around, especially at the beginning, just shows, A, Charles knew he had the, you know, there's no way he's going to go and buy. But also for Oscar, just harrying the guy in front, just hoping that he'd make a mistake, which is really the only way by at Monaco. But even Oscar said he's tried to set him up into six and seven, gave it a look, gave up the rest of the race. Something has to be done about that. And Max Verstappen was quite vocal after the race saying, we do need to make some track layout changes. We need to do something different because this was boring. I think Jeremiah, my producer, said, I think he was asking for a pillow. It was so dull. But McLaren, great form at three different tracks, very different tracks. And their slow corner weaknesses seem to have gone out the window. And now they are able to get off the slow corners faster, which makes both drivers very excited about the future. Well, that start, that start, by the way, when this is where Carlos tried to go up the inside of Oscar into turn one. Oscar held it all the way around and then beat him on the drag up to the casino square. What I loved about that was it showed how you can, when you have two drivers operating at the top of their game with spatial awareness for each other, you can do that, unlike what happened further back in the field, which we'll get to in a minute. But I thought that was great driving from the both and just shows how racy the young Oscar Piastri is. But of course, in that interaction, Carlos did get a puncture, pulled off to the left, just as, you know, you saw the tires lock up. And that would have really been it. But obviously, he was the huge beneficiary of the red flag that came out that lap and went on to finish third. So really, just a very, very strong race for Ferrari. And then Lando Norris in fourth. I mean, he had a strong race, but it must have just felt pretty dull. And just does show, once again, how qualifying determines what happens with your race in Monaco. I'm going to dig a little deeper in a minute, but what about Carlos Sainz and his moves for next year? It seems to be the hot topic every week we talk about it, because with good reason. I think he's the man on every team's lips, or he should be. And I think we're seeing this this situation where he is getting himself in these great race positions. He's enjoying being with Ferrari, but he knows he's got to get his next job. This Williams thing is starting to take some form, which I think is really interesting, but it really is in contrast to how, you know, Audi coming in, you know, that massive VW group have so much money, so much power and influence. I wonder what he knows about that program that's worrying him a little compared to Williams, because on current form, you wouldn't go there, would you? Certainly from Ferrari. But James Vowles, the team manager over at Williams, said it's all about the power unit. Remember, they had their era of dominance a few years ago. Yes, Drive to Survive fans, yes, Williams was very dominant back in the day. So let's just see if, you know, Mercedes are talking very highly about their engine program, which is maybe what is going to be the determining factor. So while I personally would love Red Bull to be offering him the second seat, it does seem every day that there's a little bit more drip feeding of media content saying that Sergio Perez will be retained, even on this mediocre form. Maybe it does get down to, guys, the fact that he doesn't cause Max Verstappen any grief as a teammate. But at the same time, he also doesn't do him much good, because the way with McLaren having two cars right up there, with Ferrari having two cars right up there, Mercedes about to sniff into the game, you have to have two drivers performing at their best, optimizing for strategy and just manufacturer points. And if he causes them to lose the manufacturer points again, then, which he has done a few years ago, then I think Sergio, just in my opinion, doesn't really deserve the seat. There are better options. Let's talk about that crash. Holy cow. It was avoidable, but isn't every crash avoidable in a way? And as I said earlier, we've seen cars go side by side through these corners, and with the right awareness, you don't touch. But Magnussen, Kevin, I really like him, but what makes him great is he's like a terrier. Have you ever had that when your dog, a little dog's like chewing at your ankles and you can't shake it off? That is Kevin Magnussen, and he is not ever going to back out, even when he's at the back of the field, the two houses back there with Sergio Perez, who you know shouldn't be there. You know his car's faster. And you'd have thought with that 10 points he's got on his license, he's about to get banned. a one race ban, and he didn't get it. They did not penalize him for that. Apparently, because you could see on the video that Perez looked to the right, he knew he was there, and there didn't give him the room. And look what a consequence. But just shows, doesn't it, how the safety has improved, because that car was absolutely destroyed. I mean, the debris, everyone's probably seen that photo, that video on Instagram going around, taken from the photographer's side of the wall. And that cloud of debris and carbon fiber shards and dust as he hit the wall was absolutely outrageous. Shows the force, what goes wrong. So anyway, that was no more to be written about that accident, because there was no penalties. But I think it's really going to affect the cost. I mean, they're saying, Christian Horner said today, maybe it's $3 million of damage. And with the budget cap, that's very tough. Maybe the most cryptic words of the weekend came from Lewis Hamilton. He said, I don't think I will be out qualifying George for the rest of the year. He's not being a defeatist. He's not talking about the fact that he is not as fast anymore. I think it's more a reference to the fact that that divergence that I talked about, when you are a driver who's leaving a team, at some point you've got to start to be ostracized from team briefings and technology meetings and the planning for the next year's car. And I think that's happening. So I think that's probably the start of the end of this little Mercedes story for him. But remember, he must be also be quite excited to see how fast Ferrari are going on the other side. One of the criticisms of these big street races is the cost of entry and how it really excludes the ordinary guy. And the Miami Grand Prix have been through it. And certainly last year here in Las Vegas, it was an issue. On the other side, every single one of the VIP packages here at the Wynn was sold out. So it definitely catered to a certain audience. But the Las Vegas Grand Prix, the F1 group that control the race here, are very conscious that there are really genuine, dedicated racegoers that need to get the chance to come and attend this race. So in some very exciting news, they just launched it on their website. They're called Backpacker Tickets, and they are offering on their website the ability to come to Las Vegas this November for as low as $150, which for many of the people I talk to sounds very appetizing. So go to their website at Las Vegas GP and check it out, because I think there's many more ways than you'd expect to be able to attend this amazing race. And if anything like last year is expected, it will be an amazing spectacle. So go and check it out. Well, anyone that knows me knows I like a little bit of revelry. And so apparently does the Wynn Las Vegas. They've recently revealed Revelry, which is an all-new culinary festival. It brings together some of the world's most esteemed chefs, best-in-class vintners, mixologists, art installations, and live entertainment. Now, the festival of events includes an East meets West collaboration dinner, a mixology masterclass, an all-star chef's dinner, a Four Sixes Ranch Country cookout, a Casbah marketplace, and so much more. And it all takes place at incredible venues around this beautiful property. Revelry takes place Wednesday, June 5th through Saturday, June 8th. And it's all here at Wynn Las Vegas. For more information and to purchase tickets today, head to lasvegasrevelry.com. That's lasvegasrevelry.com. Well, I'm going to introduce my guest. He came on the show last year, Stefan Johansson. One of my favorite guys in the sport. Someone I see at a lot of car events, especially in LA. He was a racing driver for Ferrari and McLaren. He's won the Le Mans 24 Hours. He's raced at Indy. He's now a world-famous artist. His prints and originals are spectacular. Follow him on Instagram to see what he does. It's an amazing transition from being one of the world's top drivers to being a really influential artist, and very excited. Well, he is here, apparently. I'm going to call him in now. Stefan, welcome to Drive to Wynn. How are you, mate?
Thank you. Very good, thanks. Very good.
Yeah, good. Well,
back
finally
and recovered from Indianapolis.
I was about to ask, what did you do for 3-4 hours in the middle of all that rain?
Well, I actually took a nap in Scott's bus.
Okay, was he taking a nap?
I only got there the day before, so I had major jet lags. I just went and took a little nap in between.
So what did you say, Scott? I know you got a race, but mate, I need your bed. More than this is Scott Dixon, everybody. I need it more than you do.
No, he wasn't there anyway. I think he was in the engineering room of the truck or somewhere.
Well, obviously a crazy weekend, Monaco and Indy. Let's talk Indy first of all. It ended up being a very exciting race at the end, like it always is, running flat out strategy and things.
Every year.
It really does an amazing job. Let's talk about that rain delay and what it does mentally for the drivers, because I was with the Tag Heuer guys trying to talk to them about, you know, talking to their guests. And I said, when you're a driver, you get ramped up, you get ready to start. And it's like, don't we? We work backwards from our start date, putting that, you know, from our start time. And then when it's delayed, oof, there's a massive energy dump. Certainly for someone like Scott with all his experience, that's not a problem. But some of the younger guys you work with, I mean, that's a tough call, isn't it?
It is. It's always tough, of course, you know, and this is obviously the biggest race of the year. But I think you just kind of zone out from it, you know, and just rest. That's what I always used to do. Just kind of go in a quiet space somewhere, you know, and just chill out, really, and try not to think too much about it, you know, because you pumped yourself up for so long, you know, that just really tune in. It's sort of like, it's almost like a state of meditation in a way, you know, when you get into that and you just want to sort of tune out from everything.
And how was Scott's attitude, I mean, during the race? Because, I mean, I thought near the end, just the way he strategically makes his way forward, you don't want to be leading. I'm sure he'd like to have led at some point, but, you know, you don't want to be leading going into that last 20 laps. And I'm thinking, sixth, seventh, eighth, fourth, he's in the right place right now. It was on the cards, right? He could have pulled it off.
Yeah, I mean, it was on the cards. But at the end, I don't think they didn't have the grunt this year. You know, it was so, he couldn't even stay in the toe at the last five laps, you know, when they really turned the wick up, you know. So it was just one of those years, you know, Honda guys have had a big advantage for quite a while. And I guess this year it was Chevy's turn, you know.
It is. But I mean,
the way it goes, way it is sometimes.
Yeah, it really is. But I thought it was just wonderful to watch it go. And we do love wide open racing, right? We all love that. And I'll tell you, you must feel the same when you sit there on the pit wall or in the stands and you watch them go by. It is bloody quick. I mean, they are really fast.
You can't comprehend it when you see it on TV, but when you're there and you can't even lock in on a car, can you? I mean, unless you start coming out of turn four, you got to follow them literally. Yeah. You know, otherwise it's just like a blur. You know, it's insane how fast it is when you stand at the sides to watch it.
And then you see them positioning to go into turn one. I mean, it's like I'm thinking, am I just feeling this at a higher level of nervousness because I know what it's like and I know how it can go wrong?
Well, you know, it's always worse outside the car.
Right?
When you're in the car, you're in control.
Yeah.
You're handling everything. And it doesn't obviously feel anywhere near as fast as it does when you stand on the side watching, thank God, because otherwise
no one would do
we're
it.
We're all just going to retire and never come back again.
Crazy. Well, in contrast, 5,000 miles away, it was not a race at full speed. It was, I mean, what talk to me about, in contrast, Monaco as one of the most iconic races in the world, part of the Triple Crown. We all want it to be there. We all want to be there. But the racing outside qualifying is tedious at best.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously probably worse now than it's ever been. But frankly, you've never been able to pass there. You know, I mean, it's just literally impossible to pass once. Well, if you first lap, maybe second lap, if you go like a total dive bomb, you know, into one of the hairpins. But aside from that, it's impossible to pass. I mean, remember when Mansell was like 5 seconds a lap quicker than Senna, and there's just no way to get around him.
Yeah. And that car was 25% smaller than the one they run now.
I don't even know how to get around, you know, Ruskas. Well, they've smoothened out Ruskas a little bit but you know, Monaco's never been truthfully about the race, has it? I mean, it's everything, you know, around it that makes Monaco so special. Yeah. You know, it's not the race itself. I mean, everything else is awesome. You know, qualifying is great too, but the race is just sort of the Great. To crown off a jolly good weekend for most people, right?
It is a jolly good weekend for most people to get the right invite. Yeah. But you've been fortunate enough to race for two teams that we can now talk about as being at the top of the grid, right? I mean, right there,
yeah.
McLaren and Ferrari, I know you love them both. You had great success with them both. It must be fun to watch. But it really is fun to watch. Charles Leclerc was in this amazing zone, wasn't he, all weekend. Yeah. I know we always talk about home turf advantage, but it just shows those upgrades on the Ferrari seems to have come together in a very good way. But how much is it when, as a driver, you can just transcend the car like we see Max do? Is that what happened a bit for him this weekend? Car was great, but he was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, obviously, the Red Bull wasn't. Are you talking about?
I was talking about Verstappen equally is all the way back there, and Charles Leclerc had a race that a weekend that he couldn't be touched.
No, I think they've obviously, you know, clearly improved. I mean, everybody's improved, right? I mean, I don't think the grid in F1 has ever been this close from top to bottom as it is now. But I mean, the top 10 is literally, you know, tens now, which it never really used to be to the level it is now. So, but I think the bottom line today and why it's sort of a bit kind of random and sporadic where people are placing even is it all comes down to whoever can make the tire work.
Mm.
These tires seem to have the tiniest operating window, which I can never understand when it's just one make series. You know, I mean, because the tire really shouldn't be a factor, as it's one make, right? So it shouldn't be the tire that makes the difference, which frankly it is now, I think. Whoever makes the tire come alive or can make them last the longest, it's going to look good at the end of the race. I mean, Max has been quite a big exception to that. Obviously, if you look at the pace the other Red Bull has generally, but even, you know, when it's not working, even he can't make it work, you know, so... It's interesting actually how bleak a part the tires play in the overall speed of the car.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he
and it's like it seems to change in like the last race. It's like almost in the middle of a stint, all of a sudden the car just falls off a cliff, or the other way comes alive. You know, so it seems totally random, the whole thing with the tires at the moment.
You're right about it being. I mean, for Pirelli, you'd think that they would be able to also contribute to the quality of the racing because they were running slower than F2, Stefan, in the middle of the race.
Well, the second thing I was going to get to, when they're cruising around 10 seconds off the pace and not even at 80% probably, I mean, it's not
racing really, yeah. Is it?
No. I mean, and I frankly cannot understand why, even if they pack, you know, back the tire off 4 seconds left. Who cares? There's no reference point. You know, but have a tire that have a big enough operating window that everybody can drive flat out the whole race.
Yeah.
Because that's how, you know, I mean, if all the guys there had been on the limit, it's a pretty good chance someone would have eventually made a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know, but when you're at 80%, I mean, it's just like, I mean... like driving on the freeway.
I mean, it really is. Max asked for a pillow, I think, at one point.
Yeah.
So dumb.
I saw his comment after the race, which is true, you know, like when you're bored around Monaco, something's...
Yeah, but I mean, when you think he caught George by 20 seconds in 8 laps, which on any other track means you're about to become a victim, right? The car in front.
Yeah.
Boom. And that's it. Catch up.
Yeah.
Sit behind.
Well,
Jeremiah and my producer, we were talking before we came on, and he was asking me, totally in disbelief, that as a fan, they have all that strategy. They're going to run one tire compound. You know, they know they're going to have to do a stop and somewhere in the middle of the race. They'd done two and a half corners before they backed off, right? Four, maybe five corners before they really backed off and the red flag happened. And then they changed the entire strategy and changed tires and run to the end of the race. I don't get that. I mean, it just seems it's not like you've got 10 laps on the tires and there's a performance advantage. Any insight on that? Is it just follow the leader? One car does it. They all do it. I mean, just seems.
Well, I think the time loss is so big. If you can run one set until the end and keep the pace, but then it's weird because everybody just kept the pace. No one tried to check out and sort of just leave, you know, which you would have thought maybe would have been, you know, at least for someone like Charles, you know, who's in the lead. But he really dictated the pace of the race, right? Because no one else can pass.
Yeah.
And they were literally just all behind him. And they knew, obviously, if they, any one of those had stopped, they would have been screwed, basically.
Yeah. You need everybody to do it. I mean, otherwise you're done. One of the things, you know, that I think they all talk about now is, why was Las Vegas such a great race? And it wasn't because the track's amazing. It wasn't because it was the middle of the night. It was because they had no grip, right? So they're sliding, they're locking up under
brakes.
And
they're all flat out. They're all flat out. Absolutely on the limit with low grip. But
isn't there a lesson there?
What's so terrible with that? I mean, you know, that's kind of how it, you know, should be. I mean, at least it'll bring out a little bit of skill element as well, I think, from that, you know. So
maybe that is the
answer. Just
the
fact that they could drive flat out the whole race.
That's all we want.
Such a difference because it was a great race, Vegas.
It was a great race.
And
it's got to be down to, if you take the grip away, you know you can't brake as late. You know you turn in, you get a bit more, you get sideways. And that turn won me. They were coming out of, even in the middle of the race, you could see, wah, bah, bah, bah. And I was going,
it was awesome.
You don't see that. So, you know.
Exactly. Actually, correction. It's awesome.
Correct. It's called opposite lock, which you don't really get a lot on. The opposite lock's happening in the bar. So significance. I mean, for you with Ferrari, you must have such great memories of your time at Ferrari. And I know anyone that gets the chance to put on that red race suit is, you know, it's a big thing. How important is it, just as, you know, you've been around it your whole life, for Ferrari and Formula One to be right at the top, for Ferrari to win races? It is more than just for the brand, isn't it? It carries a lot of weight for the whole sport.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think irrespective of how many championship any other team wins, you know, Ferrari still, I think it's the only team that always have that magic, the mystique, the whole aura around it, you know, and that's why every driver's dream is to one stage in your career be in the red cars, you know, because it is something really unique and special, you know.
And that's, you totally understand and support Lewis's move?
Yeah. I think it's really exciting. I mean, if they end up winning, which they're doing anyway at the moment, and they can win a championship with Lewis, it would be like a fairy tale, wouldn't it? It was amazing.
Yeah, $100 million fairy tale. I bet you wouldn't mind being the driver manager on that one.
Exactly. That would be nice.
So let's put your driver manager hat on for a minute. I've just asked about Lewis, that you answered that one. What would you do with Perez right now?
Well, I mean, obviously he's, you know, he's not a million miles off, really, truthfully. It's just that it's so damn close now. You know, you got to get it absolutely right. But I think my guess is he would still have a pretty decent chance to stay at Red Bull, which obviously would be by far the best decision for him to do anyway. I mean, there seems to be, I don't know, anything the inside of this, you know, what the team's doing, but there seems to be a pretty decent dynamic between him and Max and with a sort of setup and things like that, you know, and he's not a threat in that regard. I mean, I think he's realizing now that, you know, he's not going to beat Max, so you might as well be in the best car and finish as close to the front as you can with that, you know, rather than jumping to a smaller team.
I mean, I think, to be honest, he works so well with Max. It's a bit Eddie Irvine-esque, right? The minute you work out that you don't, just forget about beating Schumacher. Be there to win when he doesn't win and be the second. But that is, I guess, where the criticism comes when you're not second in that car. But, you know, it's a tough gig. And as you say, everybody is so close now. Then, of course, you have Carlos Sainz, who obviously is running so well. I like him a lot as a man driver.
Yeah.
I like his attitude in the cockpit. I think he's got a lot of, and I'm sure you see that too. I mean, I'd love personally to see him in the second Red Bull seat, but I think it does sound like he's going to be more heading to Williams, which means they must know stuff we don't know about what's coming.
I'm assuming there must be something big there that we're not aware of, because why would you even
talk about it?
Think of going there at the moment. Otherwise, I mean, all I hear even from them internally is that complaints about their systems are antiquated. You know, everything needs to be updated. So
I think they have someone like you running their technology side.
Big leap forward there somehow, you know.
Judging by the difficulty we had getting on the show, they probably have someone with your tech background running.
Let's hope not.
Running their spares department. Formula One is such a savage sport, though, and it should be at the top. You should be fighting for your place. And I got to say, I kind of ended up having to eat my words a little bit on, with Aston Martin and, you know, seeing Lance, you know, he's running really well. He's ahead of his teammate, Fernando Alonso, in the last couple of races. So, you know, and Danny owns the team, so we'll leave him out of it. But Logan Sargeant causes me some angst because there are so many great drivers on the sidelines and he's had two seasons to prove it. You manage drivers and you must have had those moments yourself when it's just not going right and you talk yourself into this death spiral of performance. I wouldn't keep him, would you?
I guess it depends on the
economics.
A lot of different factors. Well, obviously, I'm sure the economic side of it is one factor, I'm assuming. But you're right. I mean, I think that there are obviously some incredibly talented drivers sort of on the sidelines at the moment. I think that deserve a chance. But, you know, Formula One, if you look historically, I mean, it's probably more seats filled now by ultimately about as good guys as you can get in the cars, you know. So I think, but having said that, I mean, a few had, you know, sort of become journeymen now, I think. So I think maybe that should cause reason to, you know, for some of these teams to look at some younger talent and see if anyone is a megastar in the making.
Yeah, because I use the words, it's a savage environment, but at the same time, we do see people being given like headroom to improve, which you need as a driver, don't you? You can have a bad weekend. You want your crew chief and your team manager to put their arm around you and say you can do better, because they're all young men, man. You know, we forget.
Well,
we forget how
exactly
they're at the top, but they're young kids.
Yeah, I mean, very young. I mean, you know, I don't think, frankly, most of them are. I mean, you get the unicorn like Max or Lewis, you know, when they came in really young, and they were immediately brilliant. But they are exceptional drivers too. I mean, they are, you know, one in, you know, a million, you could say, almost, you know. So, but then you got the other guys who are all very, very good. Of course, don't get me wrong. I mean, they've been good in junior categories and everything. But when you get to that stage, you know, 90% of the greatness is really in the head. It's not the raw talent anymore. And that's what makes the difference, I think. You know, that's why you end up with, I mean, I want to name it, but let's say Ocon or, you know, Gasly. I mean, they've been around for a while, but can't seem to kind of crack it into like a team where they can consistently be winning, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's I like watching Yuki, right? I mean, Yuki Tsunoda, he's outperforming Daniel pretty consistently, and you know, I don't think he's elevated to the point he should have that second Red Bull seat, but he certainly should be right where he is. I mean, I think
he's a classic example, because had it been in any other program than Red Bull, I think he would have been out of a drive already in the first couple of years, you know. But he's improved a lot. I mean, he's actually doing a really good job, I think, you know. And that he would have never got to that point, you know, under normal circumstances, I don't think. So I think if they are given the chance to screw up a few times when they're younger, you know, then generally that would start blossoming. But on the other hand, you can say that maybe there should be something in between, you know, that they can gain some more racecraft, because I think that's what's lacking is a lot of these guys. It's just, it's not speed. It's just the racecraft.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm going to ask for two sides of Monaco now. We saw that crash with Checo going up the hill there with Magnussen. And, you know, Kevin, he is so feisty. I compared him to like a Jack Russell Terrier a minute ago. You know, I mean, just doesn't stop nibbling at your ankles. Both of them were probably at fault there. But the consequences of that, mate, were, I mean, there was the tub left. That's it. And now, you know, you were from an era when you wouldn't have walked away, one of your best friends, Elio De Angelis, did not walk away. I mean, we saw some horrific moments. What does it gutturally do to you when you see a car explode like that and the shards are coming? What does it, I mean, we live in a safer time, but does it still resonate with you and bring back those deep memories?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I think the difference today, I mean, everything is so much better from a safety point of view, obviously. And when you have a shunt like that and it looks spectacular with stuff flying everywhere, it's actually probably better than when you just go thud, you know, and it's like, it's just as big a hit, but nothing gives, you know, and that's when you normally get injured. So I think it's the way they've developed all these crash zones and everything on the cars, you know, and the fact that they actually do come apart, I think is almost better from a safety aspect, you know.
Yeah, but boy, it was
I mean, it looks spectacular, but, you know, it was, definitely.
Not if you're a marshal on the outside. As they say, Jamie Price, but, you know, the best, one of, in my opinion, one of the best photographers. Yeah. And he was there and he goes, yeah, you never turn your back to the cars. You know, always keep an eye on it. That was the negative side of it. But do you have a particular Monaco memory of just the drivers having fun? I mean, I know there's some we can't talk about. That's for when everyone's dead. But Monaco must have been just a party into the night on Sunday. It was always like that. Anything that comes to mind?
Well, you always get that, but, you know, I don't recall actually ever even going out. I mean, after the race, you just, it's kind of over the weekend, you know, you have dinner at home, but it was never like any big parties or anything, to be honest. I mean, well, there probably were, but I don't think many drivers took part. You know, obviously there's loads of parties everywhere, but I don't think any driver would sort of turn up unless there was a, you know,
someone paying them
or something. That,
I think Leclerc went out because it is his hometown.
Yeah, right? He might have, you know. Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe there was.
Who knows?
But I mean, nowadays, it wasn't really that frequent at all, those events. Every now and then, here or there, but very, very few times that anyone actually sort of participated.
Okay, that's the most boring answer you've ever given me to anything, because I know. Well, hey, listen, everybody who's watching, there is also another side to every one of these stories, and believe me. But the difference was, Stefan, there was no social media, so no one knew what everyone was doing.
Exactly. Yeah, that's also true. Yeah,
that was the magical key. All right, quick now time. So now time for the Mobile One pit stop. Just a couple of little questions for you. When you watch a race like Indy or Monaco or Daytona or Le Mans, which of those do you still gets you in your gut and you wish you could compete in? Just one more time.
I don't think, honestly, I've completely shut it down, so I have no desire to get back in. But if I were to, it's a toss-up really between Indy and Le Mans. They're both equally great in their own way, you know. The race at Le Mans is absolutely amazing, you know, to be out there. You've done it, Justin. I mean, you know, when the sun comes up at, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, whatever it is, you know, you're just barreling down those straights there. It's sort of like almost romantic in a way.
It is.
You know, but it is an amazing feeling. You know, you're on the limit and it's just so cool, you know. And then equally qualifying at Indy is just the absolute maximum for a racing driver. When you got the thing trimmed out to the point where you're just like literally just floating. And you manage to, you know, control it the way it should be. It's an incredible feeling for a driver.
Race critics or art critics? Well, which would you rather face?
Well, I think critics general. I don't know. Equally bad, I would say.
Equally bad. You mentioned it really. Most fun track to race on. What was the destination you always looked to, which track worldwide, just to be there as part of the ceremonies?
We always used to love going to Australia. It's the last race of the year. We raced in Adelaide back in those days, and then, you know, just Australia in general, just stayed either went there early or stayed a little bit behind. And used to love going to Japan. I lived out there the first couple of years in my career. We quite a few of us European drivers lived out there, so that was a fun experience. And then Monza is always very, very special, of course. But you know, there's so many cool tracks, especially the sort of old school tracks here in Europe too. That's Spa, you know, it's just Silverstone, some fantastic race.
Yeah, I mean,
So
we're
many good
lucky.
places.
So many good places. So out of the guys that, I mean, I know you represent Scott Dixon. It was funny last week. I asked Dario who from IndyCar, if he had to put into a Formula One seat right now, which driver it would be, and he said the old boy. He would still give Scott a shot. Do you second that? Who would you put in a Formula One car right now if you could?
Yeah, I mean, Scott would certainly get the job done. I've no doubt about that. And I think had he been in F1 in the early years, you know, if that had worked well, I'm pretty certain he would have certainly had a good chance of being a world champion once. If you can just find your way in the right team at the right time, which is really the most important part of F1 for sure. I mean, IndyCar too, or any series, but in particular in F1, I think you got to be in the right car.
What change would you make to the Monaco track to make the racing better?
Yeah, the problem is they're almost landlocked. I mean, I don't know what they can do, you know, to make it better. I mean, I guess when you come Saint-Devold, you know, where you turn right, I mean, technically, I think you could turn left and go in towards where you walk up towards the train station, then turn around, have an hairpin a bit later, further down. But it would only make the track longer. It wouldn't necessarily help it from a, you know, passing point of view. Just you really need at least one long straight to be able to
for DRS
opportunity
to work.
Because here, you know, it's just there's not really even a short straight because it's all just flowing. It's just sort of always curves a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So you never have a chance to, and it's just one line really. So you never get a chance to get a run on anyone. That's one of the big issues, of course.
I never asked you this before. Did you ever have any pre-race superstition or ritual?
Oh God.
No.
Far too many.
Did you? I thought you were gonna tell me to get lost.
I wore the same pair of underwear from my first race in F3, I think, to literally I stopped my F1 car. It was just shreds in the end. You know, a bit of elastic that held them all together on the top. Always tie the left shoe before the right. Always get in the car from the left side. Oh God. It's and never ends.
Oh. Well, do you know what? Welcome to the complicated mind of Stephanie Hansen, everybody. Must have caused you a lot of trouble at Le Mans, mate.
You couldn't go
in the other side of the car.
Yeah, no, well, you just got to deal with it in those circumstances. But
yeah, well, thank you for doing the Mobile One pit stop. Well, listen, I will see you soon. Are you going to go to Canada?
For the
Formula One, will you go out to that?
Maybe. I'm not sure yet.
Okay.
I'm going to go to Le Mans. I'm going to be at Le Mans. And then after that, I'm not sure yet.
All right. Well, I'll see you at Le Mans for sure. Thanks so much,
great.
Mate. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll catch up
Thank
soon.
You.
All right.
Take all right. Care, buddy. All the best. Cheers.
Well, hey, race fans. Justin Bell here. So what is it about a race that's so exciting? Is it the breakneck speeds, the constant pressure, and that ever-present threat of danger? Or is it simply the driving? Just think about it. No phones, no laptops, no screens, just the world's greatest drivers, cars, and the ultimate freedom. Yep, for me, certainly, it's all of the above. Mobile One for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/drive to win to find all about it. Well, great talking to Stefan, as always. I mean, just an interesting position for him, having been in Formula One. I mean, imagine Ferrari and McLaren. And then being so involved in IndyCar as well, and still Ferrari, and manages Scott Dixon. So he is in the know on so many things. Well, the next race up in 2 weeks is Canada. There's a big migration. Just think of the logistics involved. At some point, I've got to get one of those guys from logistics at Formula One to get on the phone with us, because it is massive operation to head out there to Montreal. It's always one of the favorites with everybody. There's the food, the culture, the fans. They love Formula One visiting. In fact, they love any form of racing up in Canada, and it's definitely a stop everyone looks forward to. Last year's top five, just to reflect on, was Max, Alonso, Lewis, Leclerc, and then Sainz, which I am thinking might be a little indication minus the Lewis part of what we might be looking forward to this year. But certainly coming off the back of these series of races where we've seen Ferrari come to the front with their upgrades, we've seen McLaren, both drivers, get a bit spicy and racy with not just their own mentality and their ability to win, but also the fact that the upgrades from McLaren keep getting better and better. We're going to a track now where it's a lot faster, a lot more traditional, and we're going to see maybe the Red Bull come back into play because two things. The Max factor, the car is very fast in medium, high-speed corners. But the others have gained so much. And as Stefan just said, the gap is smaller. Everybody is really in with more of a chance. So I think maybe the biggest weapon in the tool chest is the fact that the drivers know that Goliath can be taken down if you keep the pressure on, if you're good from the beginning of the weekend, and just don't let him lead into turn one. That is all we've been shouting from the rooftops every single week. As Carlos Sainz said after the race, he said, you know, the future tracks are normal racetracks, and let's see what Red Bull still has, but for sure they're closer. We're going to see you in 2 weeks. Stay in touch on social media. Thanks so much. And thank you very much to The Win, as always, for providing such a great studio for me here on Drive to Win. And to Mobile One for the love of driving. I will see you in 2 weeks after the Canadian Grand Prix. Take care, guys.